In this first lecture, we thought we would introduce you to Dante and to his wonderful poem, The Divine Comedy. First, I guess, by talking just a little bit about the kind of literary achievement that it is, and then maybe say a little bit about the way in which one approaches the poem, given that we'll be reading it in translation, and finally end with a little bit about Dante's life and times. To begin, I think it's pretty clear to pretty much everyone that this is a remarkable, indeed unmatched, literary achievement in many ways. Dante takes as his subject nothing less than a journey to the three parts of the Christian afterlife, to hell and to purgatory and to heaven. And given that huge scope, pretty much anything is fair game in terms of subject matter for his readers to contemplate, because he brings in such an enormous amount, both in terms of subject matter and also in terms of dealing with the sorts of concerns that not only would be important to anybody alive on the planet in the 14th century, but also to anybody alive on the planet in our time as well.
Let me give you an example. A few years ago, Ron and I had the opportunity to teach Dante's Divine Comedy, or Commedia, in a maximum security prison. And we had just begun, and we were talking about one of the first sinners in hell. And an inmate put up his hand and said, "That's me. That's why I'm here. I did what she's doing right here in this poem." And I think in a way that for academics perhaps hit it harder than ever before is the fact that this poem is really of universal significance and of contemporary value. Anybody who reads the poem seriously is going to confront him or herself issues of our day as well as Dante's day. Because although obviously we need some historical background, and we know that Dante's original audience is different than ourselves in many ways, nevertheless, the universality of Dante's concerns, the extraordinary breadth of what he has to say, mean that this poem really can work on us every bit as much as it worked on somebody living in Dante's own time.
Yeah, let me piggyback on what Bill said by giving another specific instance here. Like everybody else, Dante scholars were anxious to jump on the millennium craze, and they had a millennium conference, and all the advertisements went out and said, "This is your once-in-a-thousand-year lifetime opportunity to sort of talk about Dante." They even had a slogan, and the slogan was, "When we get to the 21st century, we'll find that Dante is there waiting for us." And corny as it sounded, it seemed to me it was not only effective but accurate, because the sorts of concerns that are in the poem are the sorts of concerns that are of as much interest to people in the 21st century. So that, for example, it is a poem that deals with the way in which we have to wrestle with political institutions. How are we to be governed? What is justice and what is injustice? It deals with the idea of spiritual transformation. It deals with issues like, what are good reasons for writing a poem and what are good reasons for reading a poem? So the really big issues that folks have wrestled with turn out to be central to the Commedia, and what we want to do is try and give you the best possible entryway into those particular issues.
If you will, just as Virgil and later others are Dante's guide, the purpose of a guide is, of course, to, in a sense, make him or herself irrelevant. That's our goal, too. If we're your guides through this particular reading of Inferno and Purgatorio and Paradiso, what we hope is that you will go back to the poem many times and you'll find that perhaps memories of your guide are valuable, but you're now really ready to proceed on your own.
And so to start, let's talk just a little bit about what makes the poem so complex. First thing, of course, is that it's very long. It's 14,000 lines long, and as we said, divided into three parts, and each of those three parts is further subdivided. Dante invents a term, or at least gives a new meaning to the term canto, simply means a song, and they become the sort of chapter divisions of each of the three parts of the poem, and indeed of the poem as a whole. So there are 34 cantos in the Inferno, 33 in the Purgatorio, and 33 in the Paradiso, again, the grand total of 100. Each of those 100 cantos itself a complex piece of work, and further subdivided according to another ingenious scheme that Dante develops, a particular way of rhyming things, a particular way of having a kind of small stanza, which Dante calls terza rima. What would that be, third rhyme or triple rhyme?
Exactly. And so every canto has a number of these tercets, as we call them, this group of three lines. They average about 140 lines per canto. Nevertheless, some are shorter, some are longer. But the rhyme scheme is extraordinarily important if you're going to understand the beauty of the language of the poem. To put it in the simplest terms, it's A, B, A, B, C, B. In other words, the first and third lines of one tercet rhyme with the second line of the next tercet, and then those first and third lines interlock with the middle line of the next tercet, and so on. So it's an extraordinarily complex rhyme scheme, a lot easier to do, we might add, in Italian than it would be in other languages. Oh, for example, English would come to mind.
Yeah, so what that means, of course, is that anybody dealing with it in a modern English translation is going to be faced with a very difficult problem. How do you handle the rhyme? Again, to take what Bill said and put it into another way of looking at it, every word in Italian, or almost every word, ends in a vowel, which means that if you're rhyming, then what you can do is take any word and say, well, one word out of six is going to rhyme with it, all right? If you're doing that in English, you've got many more opportunities to have the rhyme, and therefore rhyme itself is a much more difficult thing to accomplish. So the question is, what do you do if you're taking the poem from Italian and trying to put it into English? We want to say just a little bit about what some of the various modern translators have done in their attempt to deal with this issue and the problem of translation in general, so that right from the beginning you can have a sense of how best to follow along in the poem yourself. The first thing that I would say about the question of translation is this, that if you were to take any five Dante scholars and put them in a room and say, what is the best translation for somebody coming to the poem for the first time in English, you would get six different answers. Okay? And the reason for that is not simply that Dante scholars are a cranky lot and don't want to agree with each other. It's that there are so many different variables that you have to play off, that what one considers important might not be what is considered most important by the next. Let's take that question of rhyme. In our time, there has been one serious attempt to imitate Dante's terza rima in English. And while you can kind of admire it, I'm not sure that that's where you'd want to go for your first time or even your second or even your third time through the poem. Because as it turns out, to get things to rhyme, you have to do a little bit of forcing with the language, and it sounds very stilted. Indeed, what it does is it sounds a bit forced. So most of those who have decided to translate Dante into English will try to give some kind of sense of what the poetic line looks like. In other words, keep those little three-line stanzas, but not really rhyme, or at least not really continue the rhyme through the intricate pattern that Bill has established.
Not all, by the way, do that. There are purely prose translations of the Divine Comedy. And supposedly the advantage to them is, because they don't have to worry at all about setting things up as a poem, they can be the most literal and the most straightforward and not have to worry about any of the artistry of the poem at all. And although there is some value in reading a prose translation, perhaps for that reason. And, you know, I remember when a couple of my kids were in school, somehow or other poetry really put them off, but they would read a prose translation of Homer, for example. Maybe there are some people for whom a purely prose translation is valuable, but certainly most of the translations we have today, and the one we're going to use and the others we're going to talk about, are indeed ones that try to keep some sense of the poem as poem.
Yeah. Now, one of the exceptions to that turns out to be when people realize the limitations of prose, as Bill said, but also say, look, what you've got is a poem in Italian. Why not have Italian on one page? And then if you're going to use the other page, a prose translation might be good as long as you go over to the other side. from time to time. And I think that this was intended not only for people who have some grasp of Italian, but people who have studied any of the related languages. So that if you'd done a little bit of Latin, a little bit of French, a little bit of Spanish, it would be possible to glance over at the Italian side and take a look at the English translation. In those cases, the prose might be a help. Although, again, this is not the only way that it's done. Simply to say that there are a ton of options out there to choose from. Another problem with modern translation is that, as you can imagine, it's an enormous undertaking to translate a 14,000-line poem. And folks get started and publish their Inferno and say the other volumes are forthcoming, but they don't always come forth quite that quickly. And so there are a number of new translations that just came out, really terrific, but we don't know what the rest of it is going to be. So that just to give two examples, in the last couple of years, both Robert Hollander and Robert Durling and his partner Martinez have come out with translations of the Inferno, but that's all we have. And again, to our reckoning, these are both very good, facing page, dual language with neat notes. But if you want to read the whole poem, they're not particularly valuable, although it does raise a very interesting question about, again, do you need to take the whole thing from one translation, or can you read one Inferno, another Purgatory, another Paradise?
And obviously there are arguments for both ways. If you read the same translation all the way through, you become very comfortable with the language. It flows as a poem beginning in the dark wood of error and ending with Dante meeting God face to face. If you use different translations, obviously you have to readjust as you pick up each translation, as each translator used somewhat different principles or somewhat different degree of literalness or whatever. On the other hand, perhaps comprehensively after reading three different translations, you have a better sense of Dante as a whole because each one can only draw some of the things that Dante does with his own original language of Italian.
All that being said, what would we recommend in terms of a kind of relatively cheap, relatively accessible translation? For a long time, John Ciardi's translations have been much used, and he has a poet's sensibility, and his notes are okay, although not terrific. And so that would be one option. Another, Alan Mandelbaum, very nice because cheap paperback edition. He's got on one side the Italian, on the other his own translation. Problem with Mandelbaum, his notes aren't all that great. For English-speaking readers, the translation that is sort of standard is that of Charles Singleton. But the reason for that has a lot more to do with the fact that Singleton provides prodigious notes for the entire Commedia. So that, for example, what you get, if you want to shell out the $130 or so that it costs for the Singleton edition, three volumes of text and translation, three much, much thicker volumes of notes. And while those notes are wonderful for the scholar, it might not be the most useful edition for the non-scholar. The notes can be a little bit overwhelming, maybe a little bit intimidating.
And sometimes those notes are of value only if you're studying Dante in the original Italian. In other words, it'll talk about how Dante used this word variation rather than that word variation. And therefore, those who are looking for the notes that help to provide the background to understand the poem find themselves skimming through some notes to find the ones that really get to the heart of what they want notes for. And so although, again, it's a great reference, it may not be the best thing to use your first time through for a reading where you want notes that give you the background to make the stories that Dante tells intelligible.
All of that having been said, we can now sort of talk about the translation that we're going to use here and that we're going to be quoting from. Again, with all of what we've said, sort of clear, we're not forcing this on you or saying that this is necessarily the best, but given the options, it's the one that we use with our undergraduates in class, and there are two good reasons for it. One, I think that he does a pretty reasonable job in the translation itself, and also he sustains it throughout. My own impression is that as a translator, he gets better as he gets rolling, and that I think he does a very good job, for example, with the Paradiso, which is the hardest, I think, of the three canticles to translate. The other thing is that music, it seems to us at any rate, has the best notes for somebody who is coming to the poem for the first time. That is to say, notes that are fairly comprehensive will tell you most of what you need to know, but not intimidating and not overwhelming, and they don't assume that you've been reading the poem for a long time. Nothing particularly technical about what he does in the notes.
There's also a good introductory essay, and as in many translations, there are also things like diagrams of the various parts of the afterlife and a very useful glossary at the back of each volume. So if you want to find a character or a geographical place that Dante mentions, you don't have to skim back through all the notes. And it's not really an index. It really is a glossary that's very, very handy in looking up things very quickly.
Now, again, a lot of what we've said about addition leads to something else about the poem, which gives it a kind of unique status. We've been talking about the notes, and I guess we need to say something about why one needs notes. Why in most editions, certainly Muses included, the notes are almost as long and in some cases longer than the text itself. This is sort of tricky business because it makes it seem as though the poem is totally inaccessible unless you're willing to do an awful lot of work outside of the poem. I think we probably should say at the outset that if somebody wanted to go through the poem, reading it and not look at a single note, you would get an awful lot out of it. Dante does a number of things that make the poem accessible to the first-time reader, most of all because he's such a good storyteller, that this journey that a pilgrim named Dante takes to the three parts of the afterworld is a action-packed adventure story. And if you wanted to get it on no other level, you could do that. But most readers, and I think for good reasons, also see the necessity for notes, and that necessity was seen even in Dante's own time. In other words, you can get something, but there's more, and the notes are an aid to that more.
The commentary tradition on the Divine Comedy began practically before the ink was dry on the 100th canto. In fact, one of the first commentators on Dante's poem was one of his sons. And unlike almost any other of the world literature except the Bible, the tradition has been handed down now for almost 700 years of people doing line-by-line commentaries. You can find it on the web. You can find it in many, many learned volumes, that every line has its commentators so that one could do what scholars did in the Middle Ages for the Bible, and that is to say comment on every single verse. Obviously, again, these notes are a much watered-down version of this tradition. But why do we need them at all, I think, is the question Ron raised. Let me just suggest one way of answering that question. First of all, in general, when we read old books, the thing that strikes us is that we're not the intended audience, and that therefore the original audience knew things that we just don't know. And in a sense, the commentary, the notes, the footnotes, are to sort of bring us up to snuff with Dante's original audience or Homer's original audience or Plato's original audience or whatever. The reason it's so much more complex for Dante than almost any other of the great world authors is that in his journey through the afterlife, he just runs into so many folks and chats with them, and they tell, sometimes straightforwardly, sometimes not, their own stories. And Dante expects his audience to have some general familiarity, if not with every character, at least the context out of which those characters came. That is to say, their political milieu, their social milieu, and whatever. And when almost all of the stories in the Commedia are Dante chatting with folks that he meets, not to know who many of those folks are, after a while, sort of becomes a burden to us, and there's the danger of sort of losing track of the story simply because here's another name I don't know followed by another name I don't know, and I can't tell whether this guy's telling his story straight or not because I never heard of this guy.
Let me piggyback on that for a minute also. Bill has said that what you get is Dante encountering all these interesting figures whom he talks with in all three parts of the poem. Well, we need to know something about those three figures in the three parts of the poem. But we also need to know something about Dante himself, because the poet takes the very unusual and really daring move of making himself the hero of this poem. In other words, the person who encounters all of this is a guy named Dante, and helpful to access the poem is therefore something of an understanding of who Dante is and what his own life was about. In other words, the kind of biographical stuff surrounding Dante that we know as it's present in the poem and as it's present in the commentary tradition about the poem is not some kind of window dressing. Gee, it would be nice to know something about the author. I wish we knew about Homer in the way that we know about Dante. I wish we knew more about Shakespeare. But rather, what's going on here is that since he is the hero of his poem, and since he sets the poem halfway through his own life, we need to know as much as we can about that life, especially that first half, the first 35 years of it.
Let me give an illustration. Dante, of course, is from the city of Florence. There are an awful lot of famous Florentines. Machiavelli, Michelangelo, and whatever. And if you go to Florence today and walk around the city, you can visit, obviously, statues of Michelangelo in museums. You can visit Michelangelo's house. You can see the tomb of Machiavelli. But wherever you go in Florence, you see Dante. Because what's happened is, when Dante refers in his poem to a specific place in Florence, they'll tack up those lines in Italian on that building. So that as you walk around Florence, you realize how deeply rooted in this city, as well as in areas beyond the actual city limits, this poem is. You can't go two blocks in Dante's Florence, not quite as big as today's Florence, you can't go two blocks without finding a couple lines here and a couple lines there, because the poem is so deeply rooted in his physical world, his own personal, political, social, cultural experiences as a citizen of this late medieval city.
So, let's talk just a little bit about Dante. It connects so importantly with the city of Florence, and that's a really good place to begin by saying simply that Dante was born in Florence in the year 1265, and that his family came from the merchant class of that city.
The city of Florence at that time probably had about 100,000 citizens. It was very, very tightly packed together. An area smaller than today's Florence, in fact, because you had to put up walls for medieval cities, and walls are expensive, and therefore the smaller they are, the less it costs to defend the place. So Dante was born in a hustling, bustling, international, mercantile-centered city. It doesn't look a lot today like it looked in Dante's day. The buildings that dominate the skyline today, the Cathedral of Florence and the City Hall, were in fact begun about the time that Dante left Florence for the last time. There certainly are some things that Dante was in. The building he was baptized in, for example, the Baptistry of Florence, is in the earliest depictions of the city that we have. We don't even know how old that building is. So Dante grew up in a merchant family, in a time that was economically prosperous, but politically tumultuous. And as Dante, the young man, grew up, and we know almost nothing about his early years, it seemed that he developed two great passions. He was interested, passionately interested, and deeply involved in politics. And young Dante, turns out, was also, surprise, surprise, a poet.
So that what we have is, in his life before he sets about writing the Divine Comedy, records of what his political life was like. Fortunately, Dante was pretty successful as politician and statesman as he grew up, but we also, of course, have records of his life as a poet. In particular, if you wanted to look at sort of the climax of this career, this youthful career as a poet, he wrote a work called the Vita Nuova, The New Life, which is a very interesting collection of love poems that he wrote to a woman named Beatrice, and put them together as a kind of complete volume, a volume that somehow, through the poems, was meant to construct a kind of poetic autobiography. And in order to do that, What he did was to take the poems and then analyze them himself, giving a kind of commentary from his own life. And this work turns out to be an early masterpiece, which is of the magnitude that would be studied as an important work of an Italian literature, of world literature, had Dante never written the Commedia. But more important for our purposes is that the subject, other than Dante himself, of course, is this woman whom he falls in love with, a woman named Beatrice. And the fact is that Beatrice becomes a very important character in the Commedia. Indeed, she becomes one of Dante's guides later on. So, as poet, he turns out to have had a very successful career before the Commedia, but the kind of stuff that he does, love poetry in particular, becomes important when we see the transition from the Vita Nuova to the Commedia.
Similarly, Dante had some real success politically. Florence didn't have what we would call a strong executive government, but rather every 2 months they changed officials. And there were six officials who served two-month terms called priors, and they were sort of the titular head committee of Florence for those 2 months. And at the age of 35, in the year 1300, Dante became one of those priors for 2 months, between June and August of 1300. He had really hit the big time. And even after those 2 months, he served important ambassadorial jobs, as he had also before he served as prior. So Dante was a very successful political figure. But Florence was a deeply, deeply factionalized city. We'll talk more about the details of that in the next lecture. And ultimately, the factionalism reached a head. And in 1301, when Dante was in fact away from Florence in Rome, his party, his faction, got kicked out, and Dante never returned to Florence. He was born there in 1265. He left for the last time in 1301. He lives the next 20 years of his life as an exile from his homeland.
Now, notice that this is sort of interesting in terms of what we've already said about the year 1300, the year in which the poem is set. Dante takes the journey in 1300 at a time when in his real life he is at the height of his success, okay? A prior in the city of Florence, a successful poet. And yet he's writing the poem at a time when all of that success has gone down the tubes. He's writing the poem as an exile, and as an exile who really has no hope of returning to Florence. He spends the last 19 years of his life in that exile, and the fact is that he probably completes the poem only very shortly before his death. And so what we have is this paradox of the poem with Florence in some ways as its center being written by somebody who is far away from Florence, wandering as an exile and unable to come back to Florence.
And where did he go? Well, we know some parts of the answer to that question. For a while, he stayed with his faction as they tried to overthrow the folks who had overthrown them. It seems probably only in 1304 he gave that up. And then we know he went to live in a variety of places, the most important of which was the city of Verona, in the north, your basic Romeo and Juliet town. And while in Verona, it seems, he did a good deal of the writing of the Commedia. And then toward the end of his life, he moved to the city of Ravenna on the Adriatic coast. There he died. We actually have his death mask. It's in Florence. We can see what he looked like when he died. And there in Ravenna, he is buried in a little chapel attached to the Franciscan church in Ravenna. And despite the fact that the Florentines in modern times have wanted his body back and made a splendid tomb for him in Florence, he's in Ravenna.
In fact, one of the ways that it's really kind of nifty to think about the poem is to think about the two tombs, the splendid one in Florence that doesn't have anybody in it, and the one in Ravenna, kind of grubby, out of the way, a nice sign over it, sort of the tomb of Dante the poet. But the the very lack of grandeur of that tomb is a very nice statement, I think, about this as a poem of exile, something that we'll be coming back to over and over again in our talk, the notion that it could not have been written except as a poem of exile and has to be understood as a poem of exile.
And so as we move to the next lecture, we need to take up some of that political stuff that was responsible for his exile and also begin to talk about how Dante makes this extraordinary poem.